Hello and good morning. My name is Gladys Hunt, and for those of you that don't know me, I was a member of New Covenant Fellowship for over 20 years. I came to New Covenant Fellowship really hurt and wounded and rejected from another church and from the racism that I was encountering and just needed a place to hide. I want to say that my time at New Covenant Fellowship was just that. One of healing, refreshing, and growing in Christ in ways too numerous to even try to mention. New Covenant was the place that helped me discover and develop some of the gifts God had deposited in me, like my singing. I had been in choirs, in school, and in other churches, but at New Covenant Fellowship, I became a soloist and a leader of songs in a way I had never that I had never had before. I'm very honored to give this message this Sunday as it is part of our country's weekend Independence Day celebration. And it is occurring during a season when our country is so divided. So much is going on. So thanks for the opportunity to be listened to about how my life has been and is still being affected by racial injustice and hatred. During the 60s, I was just like the protesters today, marching with my signs, my chants, fighting against racism, prejudice, and discrimination in housing, education, employment, the criminal justice system, policing. We had such high hopes that things would seriously change. So now to see my grandchildren today marching, holding signs, and chanting for the very same issues is very disturbing, to say the least. My children marched, now my grandchildren are marching. That's three generations of marching and fighting against the very same thing. First in this message, I will give some examples of how racism has impacted my life as a Black woman. Then I'll talk a little bit about racial injustice in the church. Where we are now, where have we come from, and where are we going? And then I'll end with a call to action. So a little bit about me. I was born in a little town in southwest Illinois, East St. Louis, where my dad worked at a meat packing plant. My small community, The Hill, was built up around the meat processing and packing plants that employed most, if not all, of the dads in our small Black community. We're a self-contained Black community, as we had our own school systems until eighth grade, our own grocery stores, doctors, teachers, churches, preachers, right there in our own little community. So the only place I actually saw white people on a regular basis was on TV, and I just thought of them as people like myself. Color didn't really matter, didn't really mean anything. So let me start with education. After the students in my community finished eighth grade, we emptied into the larger East St. Louis school district, where all of a sudden we were in the, quote, minority, and all of a sudden we were treated differently. Here's the hard part for children. Why am I being treated differently? You see, we didn't have a word for the treatment. We didn't know the word racism, but we felt the impact of it. When I learned later that our Black parents had to do the same thing that Black parents did here in Champaign-Urbana a number of years ago, I was surprised. They had to sue the school district. The high school I attended had been recently constructed and had been built in a white suburban neighborhood so far out that it was hoped that Black children couldn't reach it, couldn't get there. So the Black family sued the district and won the battle to have Black children go to the new high school as well. So we were bussed, even back then, and we as children felt the brunt of it because we knew we weren't wanted there. Not by the other students, not by the teachers, nor the administration. So while the battle appeared to be won, we the children paid for it. Imagine that, children fighting a silent but aggressive enemy, racism. So when I heard people speak of busing, I would laugh and say I was bused back in the 60s. So it was a true indication of the fact that things really haven't changed that much, even to this day. The Supreme Court may have struck down separate but equal, but inside of the schools, Black children were still separated. They were trapped in the classrooms where they were still segregated, and schools, again, tried to move so far out that they imagined that children of color couldn't even get there. Because most of our parents didn't have cars. That's the nature of racism, folks. It has, over the years, become more insidious and gone underground, but it's still there. It's still there, rearing its ugly head. And of course, you probably won't see most of it in action because it's not happening to you. You know, we can legislate laws, but we can't legislate the heart. People will find a way to get away around it. They'll find a way to get around it. And that's what the world is so angry about today. How long is it going to take us to do the right thing, to get it right? For example, I mentioned this white high school that I attended. Well, although I tested highly on all my standardized tests, was always on the honor roll, I still have my solid gold National Honor Society pin from high school. And I had a 3.8 on a 4-point GPA scale. I was intentionally kept out of college prep classes. I was tracked for office work, typing in shorthand. I knew nothing of Illinois State scholarship money, which was there to help pay for college education for Illinois students who qualified. And I did qualify. But again, I nor my mother, who did not finish high school, knew nothing about it. So while I wanted to go to college, I never thought I would, since my parents couldn't afford it. But luckily, a year or so after I graduated from high school, in the top 10% of my class, by the way, the community college movement started. When it opened in my community, I literally ran and was probably one of the first ones in line to enroll. That's when I found out about Illinois State scholarship money and that I could have gone straight from high school to college had the counselors informed me. Bottom line, I had the grades, I had the test scores, I had the GPA, but I was Black, and the powers that be thought I might make a good secretary. Certainly not college, right? And I bet if I could go back and talk to those people right now about this, they would swear on a stack of Bibles that they were not at all racist or prejudiced. But what they didn't know was that the system they were upholding and adhering to was racist. What if I had not followed up with the community college movement? What if they had told me about the scholarship program and I had gone straight to college after high school? There's so many what ifs. And surprisingly, after the 60s, after protesting, after all we went through to change the institutional racism in our school systems, it did not stop there in the 60s. I came to the University of Illinois after finishing my associate's degree in the community college, and guess what? My oldest son, Theo, ran into the very same thing in his schooling here in Champaign-Urbana. One day, my oldest son, Theo, saw these students, white students, looking at and talking with each other about paperwork they had gotten from the office. Curiously, he went into the office to ask what was going on and was told, by a Black counselor that this process of students looking at ACT and SAT scores was not for him. Now, this was a Black counselor, and this is another particular part of racism called internalized racism. And it means that sometimes Black people, like this counselor, tend to believe and go along with the racist practices of society, actually believing that Black people are undeserving of certain opportunities, and they perpetuate the same practice of the dominant society. It's like saying, stay in your place. Well, my son finished both his bachelor's and master's degrees here at the University of Illinois and was working in corporate America. He went back and confronted this counselor. How many other Black children actually believed her and other white counselors when they told them it was not for them and did not pursue their dreams. Think of the hundreds of thousands and more of schools where this happened on a regular basis and is still happening today. Just last week, the Urbana teachers wanted racism labeled as a public health crisis. You see, there are casualties to this kind of systemic racism. And what do you imagine the lives of those casualties might look like today? Think about it. What do you think it might mean in terms of poverty, underemployment or unemployment, parenting, crime, and prisons? Some describe our national school system as a pipeline to prison for many black children who might not quite understand the word racism or know all of its implications, but who felt unwanted, ostracized, dumb, and constantly criticized in schools in our countries, in our country. I participated in this suit, the Champaign School District suit here with black parents. I'll never forget the final report that two school systems existed simultaneously, one for white students, encouraging, loving, supportive, and another more degrading and prejudiced one for black students. The Twilight Zone, right? Let me move to another area, housing. Again, I came to see you, Champaign-Urbana, to attend the University of Illinois in 1973. And did endure some racism, but won't go into that in great detail here. For those of you interested who might want to hear a little bit more about it, maybe we can chat over the phone or video, Zoom or something, if you're really interested in hearing about it. Suffice it to say that I finished my undergraduate degree in 2 years. I came again with the associate's degree from my community college. My husband, James Hunt, was interested in construction opportunities, so he signed up for an iron worker apprentice program here in town. And he later received a letter that he did not pass the test and score enough points, so he was ineligible for the program. That man fumed for more than 2 weeks. He kept telling me over and over again he knew he passed that test. He said it was a very simple test, and he knew he passed it. So after 2 weeks or so, we decided to get a lawyer. We decided to hire a lawyer to go with us and investigate the claim that he had failed this test. So we got an appointment to go look for ourselves at the results of the test. And lo and behold, what do you think we found? Not only had he passed the test, but they had not given him his veterans points. So he had scored more than enough points to enter the program, even without the veterans points. So they started another apprenticeship program mid-season and enrolled him in it. Now, again, I ask, what if we had not questioned the powers that be and went back to look at the test itself? How many people of color has this happened to? How many others did not question the validity of the test? So we both graduated and got jobs and felt we were financially ready to buy a house. Piece of cake, right? So we hired a realtor who started taking us to look at houses. After a while, we both kind of scratched our heads and wondered why the realtors were taking us to these rundown and cheap-looking houses in a certain part of Champaign. Now, remember, we had not been in CU long enough to understand that they were showing us houses in the so-called, quote, black community. That's when we found out about redlining. This is where the realtors and the banks worked together to show black clients to areas they had drawn red lines around on their maps to be sold only to black people. And anything outside of those red lines were not open to blacks. So we had to find ourselves a black realtor in order to even see a decent house that we would like to buy. So we finally found a house, we bought it, only to find out after the purchase that it was outside the city limits. This meant we had to pay more for things like the library. Our children couldn't get library cards. We had to pay for them. The bus routes were shortened, and they did not run at the time our children needed for extracurricular activities at school. We had to pay extra for the park district activities for our children, and on and on and on. In an effort to move up, we had gotten caught in this web of redlining, and it was very traumatizing to us as a family, and we were kind of held at bay because we had to pay more money. Let's talk about the history of racial justice in the church. And here I'm going to be brief as well. If one is interested in this area, there's a lot more information on the internet, but I want to make two key points. There was a troubling pattern. The first one is there was a troubling pattern in colonizing the so-called third world countries. First, in many cases, first the missionaries would go in, bringing the gospel of Christ and thereby gaining the trust and confidence of the country and its people. And once this trusting atmosphere was established, then the military would come in to take over and colonize the country. I know this is a simplistic explanation, but there are two books that chronicle this pattern in great detail, and I would suggest them as good reading material to get a historical look from the perspective of people who were being colonized. Arthur Chinua Achebe, a Nigerian professor and author, wrote an African trilogy covering this topic, and I had to read the first two books of this trilogy as required reading for one of my classes in the community college I attended. The two books were Things Fall Apart and No Longer at Ease. The second point I want to make is the Black church. Have you ever wondered why there is a Black church? There's no mention in the Bible of a Black church, not that I've found. So what really happened? So white people who used Black folks as slaves, as maids, as nannies, as suckling nurses would not allow those Black people to attend services at the local, so quote, white churches. By the way, I could not find white church in the Bible either. But the point I'm making is, as hard as it may be to believe, our present day churches are built upon a foundation of historical racism. I understand it when some white people say, I had no part in slavery. That was over 200 years ago. And that's true. But the fact of the matter is, we are still living out the results and the impact of slavery today in all kind of ways, many of which we don't recognize, like what's going on with the church, and many of which are hidden. They're institutional and systemic racism, but nonetheless, just as harmful, hurtful, and many times lethal. As one of my granddaughters put it, who's marching, and her mother's white, and of course my son's Black. She put this on Facebook. No one is asking you to apologize for being white. No one is asking you to apologize for the sins of your ancestors. But what one is asking is that you help dismantle the oppressive system they built that you still benefit from. So now let me move into my call for action. Enough of stories and histories. Believe me, I have more stories. I won't go into those right now. But just, I want to start this section off by saying, let's look at the Word of God, the Bible. Two things I want to mention. The first is the acronym sometimes used for the Bible, Basic Instructions Before Leaving Earth. And the second thing I want to emphasize right now is this question that used to be popular a little while ago. What would Jesus do? So think about it. What would Jesus do today in the unrest and injustice we're seeing in our world? What do you think his response would be? What does the Bible say about this? Well, let's look at Jesus' life. If you look at Jesus' life in the Bible, he was always countercultural in his response to the issues of the day. From the woman at the well to the Good Samaritan, from dining with tax collectors and to the woman caught in adultery, his response bewildered the powers that be, both politically and spiritually. That was the greatest threat he posed to them. He would not go along to get along. He would not be silent. Jesus came to show us a better way to respond to life's ups and downs and isms. Jesus would leave the 99 to go after the one. He would go out of his way to work with people deemed worthless in his day. His way of responding to issues of the day made him dangerous to the authorities of the day. He did nothing wrong. The Bible tells us that he went about doing good throughout the land, but that was not the norm of the day. In the second chapter of the book of James in the Bible, James begins by warning us about how we treat certain people. You see, our normal responses that feel good and comfortable to us sometimes is not so pleasing to the Lord. So our first response for us on our part is to examine ourselves. And this is a tricky and risky step, because if we have been taught a certain way, our brains get into a certain pattern of thinking and believing, and we get stuck. And when confronted, we work hard to protect and justify our way of thinking and behaving. Jesus had a powerful way of dealing with this dilemma. Jesus, in his infinite wisdom, used parables, something very simple, to dismantle one's defense mechanism and get through to them on a deeper level and make them think seriously about important issues. You see, if I say racism or white privilege, most of the time, white people's defense mechanisms kick in, and real conversation stops and is diverted at that point. So I say this seriously and as lovingly as I can. Action point one, start actively listening to people of color and try your best to understand what they're saying. Because just like the Champaign School District found, there was two systems existing side by side in the school, that same situation exists in our communities, in our cities, our country, and our world. That's why the last response to the killing of George Floyd has created a worldwide response. For the first time, people of all colors, races, and ethnic groups see what we as Black folks have been seeing and living with all along. It took modern technology, a cell phone, to expose it so everybody could see it. And if you feel uncomfortable about all of this, congratulations. You're in a good place. Don't try to formulate your response to deny anything that's going on. I'm sure that's what some of you did as I was telling my story. You thought of many ways I was probably misunderstanding what was going on and all of that. The invalidation of our stories has been a subtle way of keeping things the way they are and staying comfortable with that. Saying, oh, there's nothing seriously wrong. Those people are just playing the race card. Ever heard that or said that? No, don't raise your hand. I couldn't see it anyway. But seriously, seriously. Let's take this first step to healing this situation. And we as a church, the light of the world, should be the leader in showing the world, like Jesus did, how to respond appropriately to the woes of our generation. So we in the church should get our act together. In order to do this, the Bible tells us that Jesus is coming back for a church without a spot or a wrinkle. Is this the opportune time for us to work out all of the spots and wrinkles? In searching the Bible for this message, I found more than 20 references to partiality and how we should not be partial because it's wrong. Webster describes partiality as unfair bias in favor of one thing or person compared to another. So secondly, church, we need to shout it over the pulpits on a regular basis and work together to make it right. We need to shine the light on it, on racism, wherever it rears its ugly head, and work to dismantle it at every level. That means in ourselves, our families, our friends, our neighbors, from the country club to the backstreet bars, from the White House to the outhouse. Let's do like Jesus did. Let's tell the truth. tell stories, and talk to each other, to our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, to help them see the wrongs of racism and other isms and how it destroys lives and is harmful and devastating to our way of life, our freedom, and our world. I'll stop here. Although I have so much more to say, I worked hard not to keep you too long, but there is so much to say. You know it's still true what Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said decades ago, that Sunday is the most segregated day of the year. And we've done many things to try to change that. It's like cutting off the top of the weed and not digging up the root. It's going to keep coming back if we don't get to the root of the matter. Tune in to what's going on now. Don't be silent. Dr. King also said that all it takes for evil to flourish is for good people to say nothing. And I want to add, to do nothing. I say to you today that faith without works is dead faith. Get active. Work together with people of color, with all people. Yes, some people of color are very angry and doing things they shouldn't do. But don't let that become an excuse not to do anything and to divert attention from the truth of the matter. Let's work together. Let's pray together. Let's seek God together. Let's seek His wisdom together so that we can get to the root of what's going on and not let this thing continue for another several generations. I want to thank God for this opportunity and thank New Covenant Fellowship for allowing me to talk. And I want to thank you for listening. God bless.